Next up on This Week in Law, we've got professors, Professor Eric Goldman, Professor Devin Desai, and not Professor me, but we have a great conversation for you about DMCA takedowns, EULA shakedowns, Lego 3D printers, and a wonderful startup idea, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 219, recorded July 12, 2013, of Chalk and Anarchy. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWILL. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell here. You've joined us for This Week in Law. We've got an incredible couple of folks joining us today. Evan is out, so don't miss him too much. He'll be back next week. But joining us once again is the perennially awesome Professor Eric Goldman. Hello, Professor Goldman.
Hello, Denise.
It's great to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here. Thanks for including me.
Our great pleasure, and also our great pleasure to welcome to the show Devin Desai. Hello, Devin.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me.
Devin, also a law professor down in San Diego. Devin and I were on a panel back in January, I think it was, when I had no voice whatsoever. So I'm happy to be able to express myself a little bit better today.
Yeah, I think it was January. That's right.
Yeah. Great to see you again. We've got tons of stuff to get to today, so let's just jump right into it with something that I have been saving for when we could have Eric Goldman on the show, because I can't think of something that's more important to the web and someone I'd more rather discuss it with. So let's get right into something that pertains very greatly to the social web. All right. So the state attorneys general in our country have a little tiny two-word amendment to the Communications Decency Act that they would like Congress to pass. And a little tiny two-word amendment doesn't sound like much, but it is of really great import. The Communications Decency Act and this specific provision, Section 230 thereof, we have talked a lot about on the show. And it is the provision that gives some cover, actually quite a bit of cover, to websites that have user content. Some carve-outs are there. The provision does not protect websites if there are federal crimes allegedly being committed by the users of their site. It also does not protect websites if there are alleged intellectual property violations going on. But beyond that, for things like defamation, lots of other activity that's very commonly complained of on the web, websites can pretty much stand off and say, this isn't our fault. This is our user. That's who you need to pursue. And it's been very important to the development of the web. I don't think we would have the internet that we're all used to today if this provision of law had not been in place in the U.S. for quite some time now. So, Professor Goldman, tell us about the two-word proposed amendment and why it would change everything.
Right. So as you summarized, Section 230 says that websites aren't liable for third-party content. And that simple statement is elegant. It applies across any kind of creative plaintiff thinking to say that if the claim is based on something that users or third parties have provided, the websites aren't liable. As you mentioned, there is a carve-out for federal criminal prosecutions, though we don't see too many of those. The two I would flag are the Department of Justice's investigations of the search engines for illegal gambling ads, and then Google's settlement for illegal pharmaceutical ads, to the tune of $500 million. So that was a pretty high-value exception. The state attorneys generals are expected to request that Congress will amend the statute to say that state criminal laws would also not be covered by the statement that websites aren't liable for third-party content. Or to state alternatively, states would have unrestricted ability to regulate online providers by creating new or crimes or interpreting existing crimes to hold the website liable for third-party content. There's a lot of differences between federal crimes and state crimes. And so expanding the universe of who can enforce the crimes against websites and the number of crimes that might apply at the state level is a pretty dramatic expansion of the exclusion. In other words, it takes a very clean law and makes it susceptible to a much greater range of potential exclusions.
Yeah, it seems to me like it's an invitation for states who already are prone to want to regulate the internet on a state-by-state basis in a way that gets really confusing, that if this were to pass, we would see the floodgates of state criminal laws pertaining to the internet open even wider. Do you see that as a danger?
Absolutely. In fact, we already see it today. Despite Section 230, we see states pass laws all the time that criminalize websites for third-party content. When those laws are challenged in the courts, they're usually struck down. So we don't worry too much about them. But if you were to remove Section 230's protective shield from the internet, then the floodgates really would open up. And there's already a bunch of laws that states are taking advantage of to try to make noise. But there's no limit to the amount of creativity that a state legislator could come up with some new and very crazy law that would have a very dampening effect on the internet.
Eric, what do you think about the states arguing that, well, if intellectual property owners have their own avenues of pursuit against website owners, then shouldn't, you know, aren't our interests in protecting the citizens of our state from crimes, aren't those interests even stronger than some private commercial right?
Yeah, that's a really great point because we do have to ask the question, why did Congress exclude intellectual property claims and federal criminal prosecutions and nothing else from Section 230's protective shield? There is actually a third one we haven't talked about, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act or ECPA, but let's just ignore that because it's really in my mind a null set. What I would point out is that we've learned a lot from the differential treatment between intellectual property claims against websites for third-party content and all the claims that are covered by Section 230. So while we might say that intellectual property rights are no greater import than, say, crimes defined by a state, we've also learned what happens when we create an exclusion to Section 230. In my opinion, things don't go nearly as well. And that would certainly be the case and multiplied by many times with a state criminal exclusion to Section 230.
Devin, this is not something that we're necessarily seeing on the front page of the New York Times. It's sort of an under-the-radar issue right now, but one that has a lot of potential import to the web. Do you see it getting more attention? And are you as concerned about this proposed amendment as Professor Goldman and I are?
Yes and no. To one of your questions, I think one of the things Eric mentioned, when you ask why is it, I think part of it is the IP industry has done a great job being a tail wagging part of internet policy in general. So, mm-hmm. You know, they were there at the table and when the green paper came out and they made some interesting noise. That could be one way to explain it. And then, as Eric said, we have this almost lab-like moment where we can compare and contrast, which we should do. The piece that I think is lurking out there that people might miss is this. You could set up all these nasty laws. They could have a bad effect, but it would also probably mess up, more importantly, newcomers getting into the game than anyone else. If you're at scale, if you're Google, Amazon, Apple, whoever's got a big online presence, it would be costly. It would be a problem, but you'd probably find a way to invest in it, do research and do some interesting engineering, et cetera, to address the rules unless they get truly out of hand. If you're a newbie, forget it. You're dead in the water. And I think that, I don't know what Eric thinks. My guess is he's somewhat on my wavelength on this, but that's another piece of this about why these sorts of creeps could become a real problem, because then the new players that might carve a space wouldn't be able to.
All right, totally agree. Yeah, go ahead, Professor Goldman.
Yeah, I totally agree with Devin. Absolutely right. And the way I frame it is that I'm not fighting for the existing players. I'm fighting for the players who haven't been born yet. And we've already seen some recent entrants into the marketplace who have benefited from Section 230. Think about sites like Pinterest that come out of nowhere. They are able to challenge existing incumbents in part because they receive this protection. I would only add to that, there are some existing players who also benefit from Section 230, but wouldn't have the ability to adjust to a different regime. I'm thinking about sites like Craigslist or Wikipedia or the Internet Archive, sites that are very large in scale, but run on a very lean staffing and provide most, if not all, of their services to their consumers for free. So it's not just the new entrants, the people who are entering, but I'm also interested in preserving these sites that have low import but run very leanly. Those sites are also threatened by any change to Section 230.
Yeah, great point.
All right, well, let's make dead newbies our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We drop these passphrases in case you are listening to the show for continuing legal education or other professional education credit in your jurisdiction. It helps some folks be able to demonstrate that they actually listened. We'll put another one in later on. Interesting that you mentioned Craigslist, Eric, because it's your theory that the state attorneys general's are upset about adult services ads on Craigslist, and that's potentially one of the reasons driving their desire to have state criminal laws exempted from Section 230. Isn't that right?
Yeah, in my blog post, I speculated that the state attorney's general request was being driven by their pursuit against online prostitution ads. They successfully kicked Craigslist out of that industry, got them to shut down their adult services category, at which point the online prostitution ads moved a bunch of other places. Some of them are still on Craigslist at the casual encounters section, but the state attorneys general have really been focusing on Backpage.com, and they've passed several, they've been squawking about Backpage repeatedly, and some of the state laws have specifically targeted Backpage and its acceptance of online prostitution ads. Those laws have been struck down by Section 230. It's a good example of what the future might look like if Section 230 isn't around. Since I put my blog post out, I've gotten some additional confirmation that online prostitution ads are exactly the target. There was other speculation. Maybe this was a revenge porn motivated concern. At the meeting of attorney generals in Boston, where I first heard the news, there was also discussion about mugshot sites. And it wasn't clear to me if they were potentially going to be sweeping in these other types of problematic websites. Everything I've seen continues to reinforce that this is all the latest iteration of their pursuit over the last several years against online prostitution ads.
Right, because the argument would go, prostitution is illegal. We're doing everything that we can to prevent prostitution, but there's no way that we can stamp it out unless we can go after people that are operating online. Do you think that it's a good counter-argument? I mean, obviously, Congress is going to have to consider and weigh all of the countervailing concerns here. Is it enough for state attorneys general to be able to go after the people using these sites? What if they simply imposed some kind of record-keeping requirement where the identities of users could be turned over upon request.
So a couple of thoughts. We have seen state and local prosecutors successfully use the online ads as part of prosecuting prostitutes and johns. So we already can see that the online prostitution ads are part of the prosecution solution, not necessarily only part of a problem. Underlying the state attorney general's effort is this concern about sex trafficking. And I've been doing a little bit of research into the federal prosecution against sex trafficking. And I was really surprised by how much effort is already being invested at the federal level to deal with sex trafficking and how much success I think it appears they're having. I'm going to be putting out some more information about this, working with some others, doing some research on this. But if that's the case, then it really begs the question, if the real harm is sex trafficking, not online prostitution ads, they're just a proxy, then I really think we ought to have a discussion of what measures are already being taken and how effective they are.
Okay, Devin, any further thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Eric's post talked about, if I remember correctly, was some sort of routing around. And the thing that's the hardest thing about most of these solutions is that one of the things I picked up while I was at Google for a couple of years is people find ways, once you start stamping down the major centers for this sort of activity, be it in IP or whatever it is that one wants to enforce, currently, the net still allows you to come up with very interesting ways around dark nets and things like that. And that doesn't mean you don't go after those problems, but it does start to ask, well, what are you getting here? And I think some of the numbers that might come out would be interesting to see. In other words, if you're reducing a high percentage of activity by this, then maybe there's something to pursue. And as Eric points out, you know, if there's other federal level things that help with that. But if all you're doing is pushing it under, there's just the cat and mouse game, which unfortunately I don't think anyone's come up with a good answer for.
Well, the other reason I think amending Section 230 to take away website protections is problematic is the courts don't necessarily have an easy time with Section 230 as it is. Professor Goldman, on your blog, you're constantly writing up Section 230 cases and the various anomalies that are out there when courts get it wrong. It looks like we just recently had another one in the case of ex-Bengals cheerleader Sarah Jones and her suit against the Dirty. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So the Dirty is a website that allows users to submit photos and commentary that is almost exclusively going to be gossipy and almost exclusively going to be critical of the people discussed. It's not my kind of website. I can't give you a lot of perspective on what's there. Don't spend a lot of time on a site like that personally. But those sites are popular, and there are many other types of sites in the same model. Based on these user submissions, the editor of the site, Nick Ritchie, will then select the posts that he wants to publish, and then he has his own little snark to it. Usually it's a one-sentence thing that tries to pull out some inanity from the submission. And Sarah Jones, the ex-Bengals cheerleader, was featured in two posts to the Dirty. The post made some very damning allegations that she had had sex with all the football team members, that she had picked up venereal diseases along the way, and so on. And Nick Ritchie's comment to one of them was, why are all teachers freaks in the sack? Which is the typical kind of snark that he would have. I would take the position something like that is probably not susceptible to being defamatory. There's really no way to take that statement and make it a falsifiable statement of fact. So in any case, it turns out that Sarah Jones had some issues. She was convicted of a felony for having actually had sex with one of her students while he was underage. So she nevertheless pursued the Dirty for defaming her in making these assertions about her behavior. Nick Ritchie defended, saying, I didn't say anything defamatory. I don't know what my user said, if it's true or not, but I'm not responsible per Section 230. And the district court judge in that case did what we sometimes see. He basically said, I see Section 230. I don't like it. And I'm going to craft together a bunch of little one-off flippant statements from other courts to try and cobble together a reason why Section 230 doesn't apply here. There was no coherent, thoughtful argument to this. It was, let me collect a mosaic of exclusion, Section 230 exclusions. The judge ruled that Section 230 did not protect Nick Ritchie for what the users had submitted that he published. And then that set up the case to go to the jury for whether, in fact, the statements were defamatory. Remember, again, she was convicted of a felony, which certainly did not help her reputation, probably hurt it. But her attorney was focused on the time period between when the post came out and when she actually committed the felonious behavior, and said that her reputation could be hurt there. The jury agreed and awarded her $338,000 yesterday, which is a pretty big number given the window of time that could be at issue. On the other hand, given the kinds of statements that we might see, the fact that she initially won a default judgment against the wrong defendant for $11 million, $338,000 isn't a complete ring endorsement of her either. The case will go up on appeal. I'm hopeful the appellate court will fix the Section 230 mistake.
Okay, but if I might jump in, I'm curious then, this starts to get into the cyberbullying, the hate speech issues, and Eric and I have gone around on this one, but it highlights a couple things. One, it was possibly absolutely purely inaccurate about her behavior. And then if you throw in the other ways that comes up, the question that people are working on, people like Daniel Citron and Chris Wolf, and I think they cause some really interesting problems, but highlight this is where the 230 stuff really, when judges take the approach that Eric described, and I'm curious what Eric thinks, how do you bridge those two? How do you deal with the just proliferation of just nasty, hateful things, and at the same time keep the web relatively open?
Well, and to be clear, as usual, the people who posted the comments should be held accountable for their posts. The real question here is, what did Nick Ritchie do wrong? Yeah. He set up a site that doesn't appeal to me, probably doesn't appeal to you, Devin, but does have a marketplace. And so we have to be very thoughtful about how we balance the fact that he set up a site that we might personally disfavor, but looks indistinguishable from sites that actually have a very vital, important role to play in our information ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of what I meant before, Denise, was this is where you get that sort of odd loop, right? Which is the temptation is to go after the sort of upper level player, right? The group that, well, if we just shut them off, we'll take care of all the other nasty things. And then you run right back into what Eric described. And someone will set up the next one. But it still poses that tension. And I think in terms of your show and things that everyone's going to be watching, the discussion around cyberbullying and cyber hate will, my bet is, start to make people want to go and modify 230 or find new ways to get alleged gatekeepers to police. And whether that will be more private market or sort of weird hybrid systems or purely the states, I think that's where the real action is going to be in the next 2 to 3 years.
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
I just want to add one more thing. We've seen a line of cases involving defamation that have suggested that people don't really take factual assertions on the internet as seriously as they might take in other media. And I would certainly say that applies in spades, so it's not like the dirty. The dirty's role in generating useful, truthful information is pretty low. So I wonder to what extent we really think of this as a cyber hate, cyber bullying type of circumstance. And my only argument here is that assumes that people took the statement seriously, and we have some reason to think that maybe very few, if any, people actually took the statements on the dirty seriously.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that many people would, you know, in that kind of...
But is that... I mean, disagree? I think legally that's the way to look at it. But we all know that a smear sticks, and the auto admit and the other cases, people just start to say, oh, well, isn't that what you were known for, even if it wasn't true? And I think the harder question there is this. Imagine you're an employer, and with a number of people who are applying, and they're all relatively close, and one person seems to have nothing mentioned about them, and one person has a question which comes from a ridiculous source. You're risk averse. Why even go towards that person? It's going to stick. It's going to have that weird edge. Doesn't mean it's actionable, but I think there is that social effect that can't be ignored.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, as long as we're on the topic of speech and defamation, Devin, let's talk about corporate speech for a moment and the fact that protections for corporate speech are getting broader, as you've pointed out recently on the Concurring Opinions blog, but their ability to squelch other speech is also getting broader. Can you tell us about the risk that you're foreseeing there?
Yeah. So I have this article. It's, I guess for my style, to be honest, it's a little bit less theoretical, so it might be better for people who are not professors, I hope. Eric always prompts me to do a little more of that, so I think I hit that a little. And what I was thinking of is, if you think about Citizens United, and the trend of late in the Supreme Court has been to say corporations get speech rights like people, and then you look at the intellectual property side of corporate personhood, they have really strong reputation protection. And that's not normally what we do for limited or general purpose public figures. And the problem is, right, you had this entity that is artificial, but is being treated a little bit more like a natural person. And then you have all these IP laws, and people say, oh, you don't need to use the intellectual property to talk about them. What's weird in trademark law is, you know, the name of the company is its logo, its persona, it projects it as if it were a person. And certainly the trademark, the Coke bottle or whatever the other logo might be, could be seen as the face. And the marketing literature really embraces that concept. But if some of us try and use corporate property as part of commenting on them, we can get hit really hard with intimidation suits. And it just, to me, looked very much like Times v. Sullivan, frankly, where the whole idea was, we should allow all sorts of voices to go after public officials and public figures, and we get to use their name and face if they're people. And the most powerful thing to be able to do is to reinterpret a corporate brand. I think on some of the material put up, there was something from Upworthy about the Coke bottle being reimagined with a whole bunch of text. And that's a great example of exactly the sort of reinterpretation that probably gets protected if it reaches court. But the costs there are really high. So what I've been trying to argue is that you could start to really think about it with actual malice standards and maybe give the average speaker a little more space to be able to criticize corporations using their own IP as a way to basically increase information in the marketplace, for want of a better way of putting it.
So tell us about, I was so surprised to read this case in San Diego where Jeff Olson, this 40-year-old guy, is being prosecuted, criminally prosecuted, for he got ticked off at Bank of America about something and wrote anti-mega bank messages on sidewalks in San Diego in water-soluble child's sidewalk chalk, which I have a garage full of right now.
And you know, watch your children.
Yes. Instead of taking his, you know, opinions to the internet, as many people do, he took them to the sidewalk. And in California, we have these anti-vandalism laws that, and how unlucky for him, he's facing a 13-year jail sentence and a potential $13,000 fine because he got, what did he get ticked off about? Do you know, excessive ATM fees or something?
I believe he styled himself as part of the Occupy concept, right? That in general, he was saying the big banks are taking fees, they're doing bad things, and he was trying to urge people to go to credit unions, which he thought were banking systems that were more in favor of consumer interests. And everything I could find, because I was a bit surprised too, I was like, really? On the sidewalk with water soluble and you went after it for graffiti and vandalism. This is a bit extreme. And it was never clear to me whether Bank of America was asserting ownership of the sidewalk, which would be really strange. Not impossible if it was a sidewalk that was, you know, adjacent to the public sidewalk. Some of them have that. But still, I found out after the blog post, and it was in the comments, so the jury actually gave him a complete pass. They said, forget it. You're not guilty of anything here.
Thank goodness.
But it gets to the problem, right? Which is Bank of America, as I understood it, just was so irritated that they called some friends in the anti-gang unit, and they went to the city prosecutor's office, and they went after him. You know, at one level, that's okay, but you have to wonder, where was the discretion here to say, this is not something we should be going after? And the other peculiar thing was the judge saying, well, there's no way you can bring up a First Amendment defense because the statute simply doesn't mention the First Amendment. And I was thinking, I don't even know what you're talking about here. But it shows a little of companies are absolutely willing. In that sense, they are like people, right? They take it very personally. And they're more than willing, like any human being, in that sense, people are behind it, to go after someone. And I think that's where keeping a little bit more of an eye on how the law should make sure that you know, the rest of society gets to have a voice is important.
Yeah, Eric, I've always thought this was a really interesting area of the law, as the internet gives corporations more of a way to have personhood and relatability and more venues where they can have actual speech as opposed to just advertising or promotional or PR messages. Do you think the law here is still in flux?
Well, no doubt it's in flux. I do think that things are getting slightly better. Trademark law is still out of control. It still allows companies to overclaim their rights. I would slightly disagree with Devin. We still see individuals overasserting their rights as well, using things like the right of publicity. So I'm not sure that companies are any worse on that front than individuals. But we definitely see overclaiming, where people and companies take the position, you talk about me, you infringe my rights, that's not okay. I think we've seen enough Streisand effect blowups that people are beginning to realize that they have to be thoughtful about which discussions they need to pursue. I don't think that the law has changed in that respect, but I think that trademark owners are becoming a little bit more thoughtful about when to use it. Certainly the bigger brands are. I think many bigger brands have realized that the very best thing you can do is just turn the other cheek. Whereas the most time when we see the blowups, it's what I'll call the crazies, you know, the people who aren't repeat players and who just had a freak out. So I actually remain a little bit more optimistic that we're going to see companies realize that they simply have to tolerate discussion, irrespective of what the law says. The law probably doesn't help them, but they can't even use the interim effect to shut down this conversation.
Just to clarify, Eric, I agree with you about right of publicity. I was just suggesting that sometimes people might be, and maybe I'm making a mistake on that, and thinking that corporations are somehow worse or better. And I'm saying that this is Sullivan and the individual thing shows that that's just a natural instinct. Humans will use, and in that sense, when they're running companies, you take it personally, you want to protect your reputation. So, you know, the question is, where do those lines get drawn, as you're saying? I don't know that I fully agree. Yes, a few companies are becoming more savvy about when to pick their battles, but I still know enough people who, you know, let's just say enough in-house counsel and others who say, yeah, you know, we still like scaring people because in the long run, it's better for us. And so they'll write the smaller letters and things like that. So the balance might be shifting. I'm just hoping that there's an easier way for the individual to say, yeah, you know what? You really should be embarrassed by this so that it shifts even more towards what you're describing.
Yeah, and on that point, one of the things that I'm working on is trying to get a federal anti-SLAPP law. SLAPPs are strategic lawsuits against public participation. They're basically lawsuits designed to squelch socially beneficial speech. We have a very powerful anti-SLAPP law here in California. It can even apply in the trademark context when we see efforts to scrub socially beneficial speech from the ecosystem. So I actually am hopeful that there are some ways that we could make bona fide progress on that. And for anyone interested in being a part of our efforts on federal anti-slap laws, please contact me. I'd be happy to work with you. Just the only point about why I think the conversation changed a little bit. When I hang out with trademark lawyers in the CLE programs talking about best practices, the conversation, I think, really has shifted in the last 10 years. Most of the time, the trademark lawyers are telling brand owners, let it go, guys. You got bigger fish to fry. And that's not the discussion we were having 10 years ago.
All right. Great thoughts, you guys. Let's make sidewalk chalk our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. With folks like Professor Goldman and Professor Desai on the show, I think you guys can understand why we think it's a good idea, if you're a lawyer, that you go to your local jurisdiction and see if you can get some credit for listening to the show, because the insights that people express here are really wonderful and educational. So we have a page on the TWIT wiki all about that. That's at wiki.twit.tv, find This Week in Law. And there's a bunch more information about how to do that in your particular jurisdiction. Since we've been talking a bit about protecting websites from third-party liability, let's shift gears into the copyright arena and see if we can have any kind of certainty, or if it's just a morass, about the DMCA.
Did you make those scratcher noises yourself, Denise?
I did not. Our intern last summer, Franklin Graves, made the bumpers that we use for the show, and we just love them. So thank you so much, Franklin, for everything you did for us. All right. So I just thought it would be worthwhile to kind of catch up. You did recently on your blog, Eric, on the Section 512 safe harbor cases and where things stand in the wake of Viacom versus YouTube and some important decisions that we got from the trial court there, and then the Court of Appeal, and then back down to the trial court where Viacom's claims were dispensed with once again. However, we're left with kind of some muddy guidelines for other judges and other cases. So whereas Section 512 provides another safe harbor kind of arrangement where websites are protected from the actions of their users, this is why Section 230 can carve out intellectual property, because we've got Section 512 of another provision of federal law here dealing with the intellectual property situation. And it's not that websites are immunized from liability, but anyone who's familiar with YouTube has probably heard of, anyone who's watched our show has probably seen recently, Fred Von Lohman's great notice and takedown how-to and informational video about how you can have something removed from YouTube. And that whole process, because it exists, gives YouTube and others a bit of protection from the infringement that goes on from time to time on their sites. So the question now remains, when people can be sued for those infringements, because they continue to go on. And I think that we're still in kind of a thicket here, aren't we, Eric?
Yes, we are. And I wish I had some nice quick soundbite about the state of the law and where we are, and I got nothing for you. and it's really gotten out of control. It's a point of personal pride that I try to blog every Section 230 case I see, and I used to also blog every Section 512 case I see, and I just can't keep up. There's so many of them coming out, and they're so long. They take me hours to digest and blog, and I just cannot keep up. That's why I did the recap post. I basically killed my 4th of July weekend going back through all the things I had seen over the last year and trying to at least say a few words about them, because I simply could not do them in real time. So just to go back, Section 512 says that web hosts are not liable for user-committed copyright infringements in general. But if a copyright owner gives a takedown notice and the web host fails to expeditiously remove the item in response to that takedown notice, then the web host takes liability under default rules along with the user who posted it. So the basic model is referred to as the notice and takedown scheme. We expect the copyright owners to send in a notice, and we expect the web host to respond to that notice and fix any infringing activity. Depending on how you count them, I think I'm now up to 14 different requirements that a web host must satisfy before they're eligible to get the safe harbor. That's 14 different things that copyright owners and web hosts can fight about, which is why these opinions are so damn long, because there's just too much to fight about. So, for example, there's a requirement that or a provision that says that if a web host has actual knowledge of infringing activity taking place, then they don't get the benefit of safe harbor. Normally, we expect the way they get actual knowledge is from a takedown notice that the copyright owner sends. But the courts have said that there are other ways that web host might know that there's a problem. And the statute refers to what's sometimes called red flags of infringement. Yeah, I really couldn't have come to any conclusion other than infringing activity was taking place when you looked at your website. And courts have been interpreting that red flags of infringement in unpredictable ways. And it gives the opportunity for copyright owners to look for ways to dislodge a web host from the safe harbor. The Viacom versus YouTube case introduced the notion that another way a web host could lose the safe harbor is that they engaged in, quote, willful blindness. Willful blindness is nowhere in the statute. The judges made that up. And nobody knows what constitutes willful blindness. So we saw, for example, in the MP3 Tunes case, that the website, the web host won summary judgment in the case for liability for its users' content before the Viacom versus YouTube Second Circuit opinion. The copyright owners came back to the district court and said, we want you to take a look at this opinion now that we've got new information from Second Circuit. The court looked at that and said, well, there's this new thing called willful blindness, and there's a bunch of things that the copyright owners pointed to that might qualify willful blindness. Let me overturn summary judgment, send this case to a trial. In other words, defendant had one. I'm changing my mind, giving the plaintiffs another chance to go to trial. At minimum, that costs a lot more money for defendants, and it makes the safe harbor that much more risky for them to rely upon. So it's anarchy. We have red flags infringement, willful blindness infringement. We've got plaintiffs arguing all kinds of things qualify as potentially disqualification from safe harbor, and each case seems to be decided on its own facts.
Wow. So on the one hand, we have anarchy, but you've been pretty much in an optimistic vein lately, Eric, and you wrote about this, that when Viacom once again goes up to the Second Circuit on appeal now, that they will press the Second Circuit to clarify that willful blindness hairball it coughed up, as you said. And ideally, the Second Circuit will fix that mistake and recant the whole willful blindness thing. So I guess we can look forward to that. Do you think that will happen?
Sadly, no. I'm sorry if I ever shared any sense of optimism with you. That's not who I am.
okay.
But no, and in fact, what we're seeing each time that the appellate courts are getting 512 cases, we're seeing them add just one more little tweak to their interpretation of the statute. And the accumulation of each of these tweaks is what's caused there to be all these elements that the parties can fight over. I don't think the Second Circuit's likely to be so decisive as to say, let's prune some of those tweaks that we've added. They might help narrow them, and that would be useful. But we're seeing over and over again the appellate courts make the analysis more complicated, adding more things for the parties to consider. Each time they do that, they've ratcheted up the cost for both parties, and they've increased the odds that the safe harbor won't apply. And The appellate courts don't seem to really be concerned about that. In other words, they resolve the matter on their desk. If that means that it's more expensive and more risky for a web host, that's not their problem. And I don't think the Second Circuit's likely to fix that. I think the institutional dynamics point towards even more murkiness coming from them rather than less.
Devin, if you were advising a hypothetical internet service provider kind of company who was going to host videos and otherwise potentially have infringing material that they could be held responsible for, what would you tell them now?
Be willfully blind. No. gosh, I think, you know, adhere to the statute as much as you can with all the strange trills, for want of a better term, that Eric identified. And the problem, I think, is partially you have these remnants from all the way back to the domain name cases, by the way. Right. This came up actually when I was in practice. I was on I won't state whether it was the right or wrong side, but I was on Lockheed Martin's side. In Lockheed v. NSI, which was Network Solutions, for those who remember when they were the domain name central for .com and a couple other the top-level domains. And it's the same question. You know, at scale, can they police things that really do look like they're infringing? And they said, no, we can't because it'll stop everything. And at that point, they might have been accurate. But to Eric's point, the court just... the courts tend to have this sort of, well, this feels wrong, and they're going to pull on some old strings. They'll conflate vicarious and contributory liability, and the willful blindness creeps in. And I don't know, Eric, if you think so, but I think Grokster really is also lurking out there as that sense of we're tired of people gaming the system, so we're going to pull on these old concepts despite what the statute might say. So if you're a startup or in the space, I think you adhere as much as you can to the statute, but for the viewers who are interested, Michael Carrier has a nice piece, I think it's Michael, showing that this sort of ambiguity and this sort of meddling and changing the rules here and there definitely affects investment. So the hard part, to another way to think about your question, is good luck getting investment, because VCs do start to pay attention to, wow, that space is a mess. And even if you get to scale, it looks like the whole thing that we put our money into and was doing great could just get swallowed. So there's a big question there, and it kind of goes back to maybe what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. When the rules get this messed up, the little players are going to have huge trouble, or as Eric was pointing out, which I think was a great point, or the if there's something closer to a Wikipedia, et cetera, where you don't have the resources to come up with Google's content ID. Which is, I think, a great market type of solution for the back and forth between wanting a lot of material online and allowing IP owners to have a chance to figure out what to do with their content. But right. If you're a new player, that's, you know, I think that investment is hundreds of millions to make that work, just to build it, let alone ongoing maintenance. You know, I guess the other shorthand answer to your question is hire a really good attorney.
Or, I mean, and I'll pose this to both of you, Devin first. There is some momentum in Washington right now toward reforming the copyright laws. Do you think that Congress can step in and undo this mess that the courts have left us with?
Undo the mess. I probably am closer to Eric when he said maybe not as generally. My optimism on those things is always a little bit less. But in some ways, 512, when it started, I think Content ID... the fact that neither even a player as big as Google nor the industry was able to completely hammer the other side, but they had to start working out more interesting solutions, maybe it means that some of 512, without meaning to, created space for some new things. So if reform is possible and the system's not completely captured by one side, yeah, there's some hope. But what it'll look like, I think it'll be fights about exactly what Eric described that's going on in the courts, right? Like, well, what about this? And what if they're willfully blind? And if you try and put that in a statute, I actually wonder what you think, Eric. I think it'll be just another mess, except codified.
Yeah, it does strike me as the kind of language that you would find in a statute that courts have now thrown out at us. Do you agree, Eric?
You know, actually, I think there's something unique about the common law. where legislatures try to express themselves, and then judges keep layering on their own semantic meaning to it. So I actually think some statutory reform would be helpful, and it might be cleaner than what we currently have. I'm not optimistic we get there. There are some efforts in Congress to relook at copyright law holistically. I think that's fantastic. I'm not optimistic. I can't really understand how it could possibly work, how we could possibly get all these special interest groups together to agree on something enough to come up with a new look at either 512 specifically or copyright law generally. I will point out that the 1976 Act took decades for all the various players to hammer out. And that was, I think, before we had as many different vested interests as we have today. We had plenty of interests there, but I think they were different, and I think there's just more money on the table for everybody. I do shudder to think of what could possibly emerge, but I know that it probably won't be anything I'll ever teach in a classroom, because if any reform, major reform passes, it will almost certainly be after I've retired.
Well, to Eric's point, if you don't mind, Denise, there are some interesting people. Pam Samuelson's group is doing some interesting things on trying to get Congress to pay attention to the issues that you're talking about with areas like statutory damages. And I think the most interesting thing with having more players at the table is there are people who are a little more interested in loosening up the controls of copyright who have a lot of power, mainly Silicon Valley. So at least on that front, maybe like the Audio Home Recording Act, though I'm sure the Hollywood industries would love to turn back time, and that was their first moment of not seeing the way the world was about to evolve. But yeah, it'll probably take another 20 or 30 years before anything really happens.
Well, hopefully the two of you will both be enlightening and punishing students throughout that time, so that you'll be there to see it should this happen. All right. Well, we've been talking with Professors Eric Goldman and Devin Desai about various ways that websites can be held responsible for the wrongful actions of their users. And we've got one more of those topics to address, this time relating to another platform, not for hosting videos, but for getting funded. That's Kickstarter. I want to get to that after the break. But first, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ProXPN. More than ever, your online freedom and privacy are under threat. Governments and ISPs want to control what you can and cannot see while keeping a record of everything you do. Plus, that free Wi-Fi at the coffee house, hotel, and airport is putting you at risk, because your passwords and other sensitive data can be intercepted more easily than you might think. So the solution here is ProXPN. We want you to check it out. It's a global VPN, which is a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, your email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So oftentimes on This Week in Law, we give you suggestions as to ways you can be more private on the web. Specifically and particularly in the last several weeks, ProXPN is a great tool toward that end. So be sure to check it out. You get complete online encryption through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You choose. You protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites. You can bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. Its software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy when you're on the go. There's no app required for that. World-class customer support is available to you when you use this product. Steve Gibson gave it a wonderful review on Security Now, so you know it's good stuff. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we've got a special offer for you. If you use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, you'll receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TWIL, T-W-I-L. Thank you so much, ProXPN, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, our next story involves patents, so let's get to it. One more from Franklin. So let's talk about Formlabs. This is a company that had a very successful funding effort on Kickstarter. It was putting out a 3D printer, got itself sued by 3D Systems for patent infringement. Now, this is all in process and settlement talks are in the works, apparently. But the interesting twist to this case to me when I read about it at your suggestion, Devin, was that Kickstarter is a defendant here. Can we talk about that? Reading the complaint, it appears they were sued for both direct and alternatively, contributory patent infringement. Is this the first time you've seen something like this, Devin?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I don't really deal with patents in most of my work, but the 3D printing space I find intriguing precisely because of these sorts of things that we're talking about. One, it's a really wild and open area. And I think we're going to see in patents a lot of the same stuff that's happened and we've been talking about for most of the show, things that we've learned from trademark and copyright online. In fact, I've got a paper with Gerard Mark Leoka that will be coming out in Georgetown this fall about this problem. But the Kickstarter piece only highlights this, which is you start to feel threatened, you go after anyone you can. If you can cut off the money, you do. And from what I can tell and what other people have been writing online, it looks like that claim should not win, just shouldn't win. But, you know, if you're Kickstarter or any of the other companies in that space, it's kind of like what we talked about and with Michael Carrier's work on the music industry. When you said, well, what would you do if you're a startup? It's sort of, wow, if you go even further and tell anyone just for investing in something, you could be somehow liable because they might do something that infringes. That's just kind of crazy.
Yeah, I agree. It really kind of threw me to see them in there as a defendant. But I guess, Eric, the fact that Kickstarter actually vets and imposes requirements on companies before they can be on the site, you know, if you're going to analogize to Section 230, for example, their involvement here might conceivably in a plaintiff's eyes and conceivably in a court's eyes lead to some kind of liability, some kind of notion that perhaps if there's patent infringement going on, there's due diligence that Kickstarter should be involved in. That seems to me a really extreme burden to put on a website, but it's not unlike what we've seen in some of the Section 230 cases, is it?
It shows the power of Section 230 that we don't even have to ask many of those questions. We just don't care. Websites aren't mm-hmm. liable for third-party content, and that kind of ends it. And the intellectual property exception allows the question about Kickstarter here that it wouldn't allow if it were a different type of claim. I don't have a good sense about exactly all the different services Kickstarter provides to the products that are featured on site. And that could make a difference. Patent law's exclusive rights include the sale and offer to sell infringing items. So if a Kickstarter item is infringing, then we'd have to take a look at what it means to sell or offer to sell that item. And given the different ways Kickstarter provides services, it could be that they violate that directly, or it could be that they contribute to that. And there's really nothing that Kickstarter can do to minimize that liability. That's just the way it is. They can't go and do patent searches on all the products and services that are featured on their site. They can't do copyright searches or any other kinds of investigations that would eliminate IP infringement. So it really puts a site like Kickstarter in an awkward position if they're going to be accountable for what's being sold. They have no capacity to protect their interests.
Devin, anything else interesting that we should pull out or glean from this lawsuit?
I think the other piece is actually the direct patent issue, because this is showing that the 3D printing space, which has been essentially open source driven, is now making enough money, and there are players who want to make money and have decided, wait a minute, we're going to go after people. So we might start to see the same patent problems we've seen with cell phones and other things come into this space. So for all of the excitement about this space, good old-fashioned IP fights are coming to a 3D printer near you, especially now that Target is selling a consumer level one, I think for, no, not Target, sorry, Staples, for I think around $1,200 or $1,300. So the fights are going to come fast and furious on every level. So IP lawyers should probably pay attention to everything going on in this space.
Devin, do you have a 3D printer yet?
You know, I haven't purchased one. I've been playing with some with people in the maker fields. There's a place called Fab Lab that's actually a interesting network of labs that started out of MIT, and they're doing some fun stuff with it. But it's incredible to see. You really, I've seen kids, teenage, not even teenagers, we're talking like sixth graders. You can take a camera, take 20 to 30 digital pictures of, you know, call it a widget that might have a patent on it, upload it to a free service that AutoCAD puts out called 123D. In a few minutes, you can download it to another open source software, which will allow you to manipulate the file, and then you can 3D print like that. And the material science is moving at unbelievable speeds. So it's a really fun space, but it's going to challenge so many things in the economy. At the very least, this will be a spot for lawyers and policymakers to hopefully get it right, whatever that ends up looking like.
I'm still waiting for when I can order Earl Grey tea hot.
Ah, yes. The magic of the future, the true replicator.
Well, you sent a couple of, we may not be there just yet, but you sent a couple of other related links that are pretty fascinating about how 3D printers are evolving. Of course, we're definitely going to need the Lego one in my house, I think. if we can have the studio show a picture of this, it's pretty amazing. It's an engineering student, couldn't buy a MakerBot, so made one himself with Legos and the Next computer from the Lego Mindstorm system. This thing is just incredible. Apparently, it doesn't work all that well. It uses glue instead of the sort of plastic that you're used to seeing things 3D printed with. So it's good for stickers and that kind of thing. Certainly, the design is exactly what you would want to see happen. And then using different materials other than glue, more effective. How about talk about the liquid metal 3D printing, yeah. Devin?
Yeah. So the two of those really show what's incredible about 3D printing. Like, it sounds very sci-fi, and when we're talking about replicators, one of the dreams of the 3D printing world is a self-replicating machine. And the Lego kind of shows you that that's not as crazy as it sounds. That was by hand. But there are people who are working on 3D printers that can simply make themselves. And then, you know, the whole question of how do you regulate that is sort of fascinating. And then people say, well, you know, the materials aren't there. But what I'm seeing is with ceramics, you can print living cells, by the way, frosting, which I think was just because it was fun and silly. And now with the metal at room temperature, the space is moving. As I think the analogy that a lot of people brought up, it's similar to the garage culture of the early 80s and PCs. It is sort of a personal computer for things. For, you know, we used to print documents and make web pages. Well, now you can actually have something more tangible. And it's moving so fast at every level between hardware, software, and the materials that this whole ability to all of a sudden print metals, you know, like think about the chip industry. You could probably have a 3D printer that soon could do simple chips that were part of a, say, a watch, the sort of things that were a big deal in the early 80s. And it's moving with a little bit of a Moore's Law kind of feel that we're now getting to that point where so many people are playing with it. Pharmaceutical industries are going to be interested. There's a couple of scientists out of Scotland who have a paper, and I talked to a guy at Michigan State who's a leader in 3D printing, and he said, yeah, they really are now able to manipulate chemicals, which means the idea that a 3D printer, slightly specialized, could do chemical compounding and maybe create pharmaceuticals, or there's people who are trying to print vaccines and antibacterials. The upside for public health is massive, but as you can imagine, the pharma industry is not going to be thrilled with that concept.
No, not at all. Eric, you recently, or maybe it wasn't that recently now, had a patent symposium up at the High Tech Law Institute. Was 3D printing on the radar there?
We've had a couple of conferences related to patents. We had one talking about new ways of dealing with patent risk, given the glut of trolls and other patent assertion entities. 3D printing didn't come up there at all. And then the second conference we had was on software patents. And 3D printing also didn't come up there, but because we were really drilling into software specifically. And there are some software aspects to 3D printing, but a lot of the most interesting issues, I think, are the hardware pieces.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think we're headed for more legal anarchy as these things continue to evolve?
I actually had a student write a paper about 3D printing about a decade ago, and it was a great thought experiment because it really gets to the nature of why we want to protect intellectual property in the first place. So much of intellectual property has been wrapped up in chattels, in physical objects. You couldn't get access to the intellectual property without also getting a chattel along with it. And now with 3D printing, if you can manufacture your own chattel, then it really forces us to question, were we paying for the IP? Were we paying for the chattel? Were we paying for both? Should we be paying for both? And so 3D printing absolutely forces us to go back to first principles with IP protection. What is it we're protecting? Why are we protecting it? And don't worry about whatever physical object might be encoding that IP, because that's irrelevant.
Yeah, that's a really good thought that getting back to ground zero for why intellectual property exists is probably a good idea. I mean, if the 3D printing movement moves us there as digital artifacts have not been able to, then perhaps that's a good thing, do you think? For legislators to have to reconsider why we have intellectual property law at all and how it should function?
Yes, but that doesn't mean they'll do it very well. There's a collision coming in the future. Maybe it can be decades, hopefully after I'm retired. But there's a collision coming in the future about when we have to have that reconciliation, that come to Jesus moment where we say, okay, we really cannot rely upon the way we've built intellectual property law over the last hundreds of years. We have to go back and start from scratch. Exciting times, but I don't think anyone wants to do that because those are going to be really hard.
I do.
Okay, when Devin gets elected, we'll let
him. Oh, I don't know about being elected. Please, let's be serious. But that's why I started writing this paper is. Eric's student thinking about it years ago, and now it's exactly that moment, which is I get more interested when the business and technological realities that people who are practicing law have to cope with come and just sort of, you know, smack upside the head the assumptions about what's working in IP as a system. So it's coming, I think, faster with the notion of the Internet of Things. And in some ways, you know, one of the other related things in the weird way my mind works, there's something to this that actually relates to the NSA stuff, believe it or not. Everything is going digital and everything is data. And so if the thing itself doesn't matter, how do you manage that thing when it's not the issue anymore. But all of our systems are based on that. And so the reasons to grab tons of data and learn from it or build something from it are good in some areas. But at the same time, it unleashes all sorts of changes that we just don't know what to do with, I think.
Yeah, that's very true. Hey, we're talking about assumptions about what's working in IP as a system. Let's look at the assumptions about what's working in contract, an even older body of law as a system. Because as terms of service continue to govern everything we do online, we need to have certainty about how they're going to work. And whether, I think the deeper question is whether they're working well, both for the site that needs to have certainty of terms and for the users that need to understand the terms and know what they're agreeing to by using a site. So, Eric, you've been paying attention to these issues for quite some time and writing about what's going to make an enforceable online terms of service. There's a recent case where the terms of service were enforced, but the woman in question clearly was out to lunch as to what those terms were. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the case I want to talk about isn't really groundbreaking in a dramatic way, but it's a nice reinforcement of a number of different threads that we address in the online contracting space. And I just posted to my Forbes blog just this morning about this case. It's a case involving JDate, the online dating site. And a member of JDate was unhappy for reasons that were not entirely clear. She was a pro se, which means that she filed her own lawsuit, and she hand wrote out this paragraph listing all of her beefs with JDate. And I couldn't understand how they were connected. I could barely read the handwriting. I'm not quite sure what her problem was. But she sued JDate in her home court in New York. And JDate responded by pointing to its user agreement that said that all laws had to be in Los Angeles. And then they asked the court to either dismiss the case or to transfer it over to Los Angeles. And JDate did all the right things in terms of contract formation from a legal standpoint. I know a lot of people would disagree with what's right in the online context, but they had a mandatory non-leaky click-through agreement, which meant that it was presented before you could register. You had to go through the process. You actually had to both check the box that you had read the terms as well as click on the I agree button. They did kind of the state-of-the-art contract formation process. But then she argued that she thought that the contract version that they wanted to enforce wasn't the right contract version, to which they said, okay, what do you think the right contract version is? And she said, well, I don't have a copy. I don't remember exactly. I just don't remember agreeing to what you think I agreed to. She was, a litigant without a lawyer. She has no chance. But what's interesting is the court said that JDate was able to enforce its contract because they could come into court and explain step by step the agreements that they used, the dates on which they deployed them, and how they had changed over time. They kept really good evidence of the history of that document, and that was compelling enough to the court that the court didn't want to have a mini trial on this issue. They simply accepted JDate's evidence, and she came in and said, well, we need to have an evidentiary hearing because my memory is different. The court said, is that all you got? No evidentiary hearing. JDate wins this round. And so it's a reminder for people running websites to keep really good records that are going to be persuasive to a judge about the very versions of the contract each and every step along the way. Now, the more interesting thing is, what should she have done differently? And the lawyer says, well, if she enters into a contract, she should keep a copy of the contract she entered into. And then she can go into court and say, this is the version of the contract I entered into. I'm guessing most of the Twill viewers slash listeners don't keep copies of the contracts that they enter into online. So she didn't do that either. She didn't have it. All she had was memory, not good enough. What's interesting, the court doesn't talk about the Wayback Machine, but the Wayback Machine can fill in the gaps here sometimes. And it didn't come up. I didn't go and check to see what we could find in the Wayback Machine. Maybe that would have had an older version of the contract. But it's a reminder that there's an evidentiary question about what the contract terms are, and in addition to whether or not the user agreed to them. And JDate handled this one really well.
Well, as you were speaking, I think we need a startup on this, or minimum a browser extension that every time you're entering into clicking yes, I agree on one of those mandatory non-leaky click-through agreements, takes a little screenshot of what you agreed to and keeps track of it for you. Don't you think that would be a good idea?
Well, Denise, what do you do? I know that we don't remind audience all the time that you are a lawyer, but you're a lawyer too. What do you do about keeping track of your contracts?
Zero.
Nothing. But that's why you want the startup.
Right, exactly.
So that's great. Maybe we can do a little open source project here to build an app extension that will keep snapshots. I mean, once we have Google Glasses, this problem all goes away. we'll be snapshotting every contract we enter into as we don't look at it. But you're absolutely right. There really is a need for us to track that. It's not an online problem only. We also enter into offline contracts all the time. We go into the bank and we sign a bank account agreement. I don't know where your bank account agreements are. Mine are in the recycling. So if we ever want to sue our banks, we're bound by a contract that we don't have a copy of.
Right. Yeah, but it's a broader problem than just online for sure. Devin, what were you going to say?
Well, I was at a conference where some people were talking about the problems of, okay, fine, let's pretend someone's read the contract and there's all this disclosure, right? There was a law professor who was on his iPhone and in the App Store, 99 cents, do you agree to the updated terms? And being a professor, he said, wait a minute. So he went home, downloaded it, like we're talking about, saved it, printed it out, and then taped it together like the old dot matrix style of printing, if you guys remember that. And it was so big that I think it was the Michigan Law Library, there's an atrium. He went up to the second floor, was able to roll it off the top, down, across a long reading table onto the ground for a 99-cent app. So, okay, we save everything and this cool startup does stuff. And as Eric points out, as an evidentiary matter, that's lovely. As a practical matter, why bother? You're not reading the damn thing. You're not going to actually go into it and say, I actually understood this, and I'm now going to try and wiggle around with it. I mean, you're probably better off, because of what Eric described, relying on the company to keep its records properly, and then if you can, get a copy of it from them, and then if you want to go through and work it over. But, keeping it, it's curious, but I'm not sure what comes of it.
Well, it's a good object lesson, not just for the users, but for the websites as well, who might be sort of loosey-goosey about keeping track of what terms of service were in place at what time, they really do need to track that.
No argument.
I just think it's funny that we've got three people who are integrally involved in the legal profession all saying, sign a contract, whatever. I don't need to know the terms of it.
Well, it's not exactly what I was trying to say, but the problem is you can't, right? And so we rely on it having enough stuff, and actually the best practices that you both were pointing to, doing some sort of work, right? And it kind of comes out in the wash, but not in any totally comforting way there's an issue. Though there's some interesting things coming out of the tech world. There's always been fits and starts with privacy policies, et cetera, but machine learning and things, it could be that you could say, fine, there's all the legalese, but can we boil this down to the core things that you as a consumer care about? And you could have that signal to the online contract and have an app that actually says, okay, here's the things where you're pretty much, it lines up the way you want it. And here are the things where the terms of service deviate from what you actually care about. You probably have no negotiation power at that point. But if you, in some sort of sci-fi future, if that happens, you could almost see a market for better terms of services, because if enough people said, well, this is what I'm looking for, you might get some places that tweak a little if possible.
That's the old P3P proposal from 15 years ago.
Right, and P3P crashed, right? I mean, there were so many problems with that. But there's been some interesting breakthroughs with machine learning and a couple other things that, you know, I think people will still, hopefully it's not tilting at windmills, but yes, sort of like P3P, but hopefully with a better backend and viable infrastructure that you could get that. And it may not be that you're negotiating, because P3P, I think, tried to negotiate and modify the terms a little, or did it just flag what you did and didn't like, Eric? Do you remember?
No, it allowed you to set your requirements for privacy and then to block your access to any website that didn't have a privacy policy that ensured that minimum standard.
Yeah, and I think that was probably one of the flaws. I'm actually talking about a simpler concept, which is just to what we were talking about, just flag stuff. So you had a real sense of what you got into, right? To your joke about, well, why read it? Because I think if you're working on any company, I remember when I was in-house, you don't want a whole bunch of varied contracts and, you know, whether or not anyone's going to find a marketplace to signal both ways through P3P, you know, it didn't happen. But Harry Serdin over at University of Colorado is doing some cool work on the concept of machine learning to be more adaptable for contracts, or at least to let you know what you're getting.
The bottom line is that our memory is not a good substitute for actual evidence of a contract. And true. In the end, the judge wrote a 15-page opinion explaining why JDate should win. But he probably could have said, sorry, I just don't believe your memory is correct.
Well, and yeah. It's a matter of law, right? I have written and I have your word.
Exactly.
Definitely. Well, two final thoughts here from me. One is that there is some outfit out there. I know we featured it on the show and it's escaping me right now, but they try and capture the Creative Commons license that is in effect when you decide to use a licensed work so that you have a record of that. Should the license change at a later date and someone come to you and say, oh, I'm sorry, I never licensed you to use that work, at least you would have some record of what license was in place when you used it. So that seems like something parallel to what we're discussing. And then on a lighter note, though Evan can't be with us this week, he did send me something in email that I thought was sort of in line with this conversation, if we could show it. It's the quote-unquote FBI warning that preceded the movie Fight Club. Back when it came out in, I think it was, I forget 99. The year now.
99.
Yeah, 99. It's a little too small to see. There we go. It's this really was in the movie. I guess there were a few of these kinds of Easter eggs in the movie. And this particular one just, you know, makes mincemeat out of the traditional FBI warnings and says, you know, if you're reading this, you're wasting your time. Go, you know, start a fight and live your life, basically. So, pointing out that people don't read things. Yeah. All right, well, let us get to our resource and tip of the week. Our tip, Eric, I took from one of your posts. It's not really a tip for the general public, but for folks in Washington that make the laws that wind up giving us our show. And you wrote a great post, it was back in April, about creating lawsuit-free zones and how if you want to keep people from having the opportunity to sue each other left and right, we really need to have more things like Section 230 and Section 512 on the books that enables certainty. Where people can know that if they engage in conduct in a certain way, they're not going to get sued. So do you want to distill your piece into, you know, an overarching tip for lawmakers for us?
Yeah, there were two main points. First is that instead of manufacturing new laws that create more restrictions, we should create more laws that alleviate restrictions or create these zones of safety for entrepreneurs to make less risky investments. And the way that we do that, I provided a bunch of suggestions of specific mechanisms that lawmakers can use to design the right kind of safety zone so that it doesn't get riddled with the problems we talked about with Section 512. So 512 was, I think, on balance, a good thing. But it nevertheless has some real defects. It has made it not that helpful for entrepreneurs, whereas Section 230 has been so clean that it gives a lot of comfort to entrepreneurs. So I talk about things like there should be no loosey-goosey words, none of this stuff about red flags of infringement or good faith requirements or things like that. I talk about how the legislation should be pithy. It should be written in such a way that the less number of words there are, the less things there are to fight about. It gives some other design principles like that. And I'm going to take that piece, which is only about 1,500 words, and I'm going to blow it up into a law review article sometime in the future. I have a lot more to say about this, about the right kind of design principles, because I think if we can better design the legislation that we're manufacturing, we'll just get better results. And I think there's some principles that will help inform that discussion.
Earlier in the show, Virgil in IRC was asking, and this seems like a good time to ask you, if some of this uncertainty that we see when Congress gets sort of lost in the woods about how the internet works and when courts have trouble interpreting what Congress does, if we need an internet-specific governing body, that seems like a species of internet exceptionalism that you might not be a fan of, but it might also solve some of what we've been discussing today. What do you think?
Well, we already have a lot of internet governing bodies. I'll point to one, ICANN, which runs the domain name system. And I'm not sure anyone would be super excited about replicating ICANN as a governance structure. So I think we should be careful what we wish for. What I really wish is that those who are regulating had greater technological sophistication, but also that they were more empirics driven, that we could quantify problems, quantify different solutions, and then pick the best of the solutions available to us. We don't follow the scientific method in making legislation, and we see what happens in places like the internet. But having said that, we have had some success stories in internet governance, and I will particularly call out Section 230 as an example. Section 230 was incredibly prescient, and it's a fantastic example of how legislatures can get things right if they can marshal all the right resources to do so. What I'd like to figure out is how we could create institutional dynamics that got us more wins like that and reduce the number of losses that we see.
Well, that brings us full circle to the first story we discussed today and how Section 230 is under threat from the state attorneys general. Our resource of the week would help you have a voice in that conversation, hopefully. It is the Congress app available from the Sunlight Foundation. It's a free iOS and Android app that lets you learn more about your member of Congress, get in touch with them, and see what they're up to. You can follow the latest bills, see floor activity, and explore votes from the palm of your hand. So as this attack on Section 230 begins to wend its way through the channels in Washington, you can hopefully follow that in this app and let your voice be heard, as well as on any other number of hot button issues. So that's a cool new tool from the Sunlight Foundation. And guys, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I've learned so much. I hope that our audience has too. Eric, aside from just enjoying the rest of your summer, anything else you want to let us know is going on in your world?
No. As you pointed out, I've been busy blogging up a storm. So I hope people have a chance to check him out. Otherwise, as much as I have a cushy job, I'm already feeling the pressure of the end of summer. Summer ends in about a month for us. So I'm already sharpening my nails to start tearing into some new students.
All right. Well, they're lucky students to have you tearing right into them. Devin, you too. Thank you so much for joining us. Anything you want to let us know is going on with your studies or writing or any events at your school?
It's as Eric said, the summer's moving fast, but I'm staying up with the tech stuff and hope people decide to, if they want to have further questions, contact me through Thomas Jefferson or read Concurring Opinions. But the other things that are fascinating for people in the practice of law is I would say also pay attention to some really interesting shifts in growth in things like the school's got some small firm and solo practitioner clinics, and how law schools in general are starting to address how technology is intersecting with the offering of law overall. I don't know. That could even be might be a show you do in the future, because there's some fascinating things going on that front in terms of regulating across state lines. And that's part of the stuff I'm looking forward to seeing as it goes forward.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to have you back to discuss that sometime. So put that in with all the things you have to do, you know, as you're also punishing your kids. And guys, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a really fun episode of This Week in Law. If you'd enjoyed this show, you might enjoy our previous shows as well. You can find them all at twit.tv/twill and at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. Find us on Google Plus and Facebook. We have pages there where we post things during the week, let you know who our guests are going to be, and give you a chance to let us know what you'd like us to discuss with them. So that's a great opportunity to get in touch with us. I'm Dee Howell on Twitter. Evan, my co-host, is Internet Cases over there, so you can find us there as well. And you can email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv, and Evan is Evan at twit.tv. I've really enjoyed hosting the show here today. We hope you'll join us next week. We record 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, every Friday. So we hope you'll join us next week. And until then, have a wonderful week and be careful out there. Bye.